Sybil, Mary Barton and Hard Times all present the problem of England's industrial north as in need of an answer, a solution. And they each posit different ones. But they can't actually agree on the nature of the problem. For Disraeli, the problem is the rise of individualism, and we need to go back to a feudal system, a sort of paternalistic form of government, and a sort of version of an earlier idealised United Britain. For Gaskell, in her early work, the problem was a combination of sexual and political revolution, and the answer was a slightly contradictory one. On the one hand, it's a lesson in knowing one's place. Mary's desire to step outside her class is tapped, you know, on the wrist, really, and she, no, stay in your place. And on the other, it suggests that the working classes deserve the opportunity to succeed and climb the social ladder, if they have the talent and are willing to work hard. Mary Barton as a novel ends with the threat of a national, what we would now call a brain drain. The bright working class hero Jem, while cleared of murder, has to go to Canada because to fulfil his potential as an engineer, basically, because no one in Manchester will give him a job, even though he was acquitted. And of course, our good heroine Mary, now his wife, has to go with him. As a solution, it's not really a solution. You can't all go to Canada. Neither is it really very convincing, I think. For Dickens, the problem is utilitarianism, the philosophy which suggests that the world can be ruled by the principle of the greatest happiness for the greatest number, and that majority comfort, by and large, justifies minority suffering. To a man of Dickens's imagination, the idea that happiness can result from rational principles alone was anathema, really. And his objection shows itself as a passionate defence in this novel of play, of art, of literature, of creativity and amusement for its own sake. The people must be amused, he has Sissy Jupe's father, the circus man, memorably insist. But of course, the reality is neither charity, nor emigration, nor free amusement for the masses provided a real answer to the disparity between North and South and working and middle class in these fast-changing times. Elizabeth Gaskell published North and South in 20 weekly episodes, first from September 1854 to January 1855 in Household Words, run, of course, by Dickens. It began then just a month after Hard Times concluded, and it seems bent on doing something very different. I think, because of the proximity of those two books, one following hard on the heels of the other, we can see North and South as a sly address, if not a direct challenge, to Dickens's view. It's something of a reassessment, I think. And it's also a reassessment of her own earlier attempt at a solution in Mary Barton. Here is the first instalment of North and South in Household Words. Of course, Gaskell doesn't get the front page. Only Dickens gives himself the front page. He's tucked away inside, really. He was terribly patronising to her. Equally as dense of text, of course, as the opening of Hard Times was in the same journal, and with no illustrations. But you can see up here in the left-hand corner, Gaskell starts slightly differently with a poem. There it is. It's by Tennyson. It's from a poem series called London Taverns, ironically enough. This one was called The Cock. And it pleads for something other than North-South kind of novels have, Condition of England novels have asked for before. It pleads for unity, both sides working together. Ah, yet, though all the world forsake, though fortune clip my wings, I will not cramp my heart, nor take half views of men and things. Let Whig and Tory stir their blood, there must be stormy weather, but for some true result of good, all parties work together. I don't think it's too much of a stretch of the imagination to suggest that the use of a poem here, and at the start of every one of the chapters of her novel, was a sideways nod to the Chartists, for whom poetry was so important. Poetry is not unusual as a way of introducing chapters of novels in this period, but it's very significant, I think, that Dickens doesn't do it and Gaskell does, and these novels pretty much run back to back. Gaskell was not a fan of Chartism particularly, but she was clearly listening to what the Chartists had said. Indeed, living in Manchester, it would have been hard to avoid what the Chartists were saying. But this kind of poetry works as an antidote to the revolutionary zeal we saw earlier in that Chartist poem. All that sort of call to rise up against the monarchy. All parties work together is an epigraph, really, which sums up this novel, North and South. North and South's structure as a novel seems designed to bring both sides and both regions together. Gaskell does not caricature the working classes as Dickens does, or patronise them as Disraeli does, or sort of clean them up, idealise them and ship them off to Canada like she herself does in the earlier novel. Here, they are not just central characters, but close friends of her middle-class heroine. They are given voices. They are allowed to suffer, but also to make mistakes. They are flawed. They are often wrong-headed. They are brawny northerners. But they're also given a great deal of dignity and sympathy. Unlike the character of John Barton, for whom trade unionism and kind of a united front is a slippery slope to a murder charge, in this novel, they can be human and flawed without being a threat. This novel is often seen as Gaskell's attempt to make up for being so sympathetic to the poor and so hard on the middle classes in Mary Barton. And here too, I think the working class characters, as I've said, are much more human. And much more human at the beginning of the novel, actually, than the hero, our middle class John Thornton, who's a mill owner. All is well in the end, of course. Margaret marries Thornton, and we are finally persuaded to like and admire him. But only after he has learned some humanity towards his workforce from Mary, from Margaret, and given up being so proudly northern. He kind of has to make a compromise with his own identity, I think, in this book. Gaskell starts our introduction to the North as Margaret Hale is forced out of her bucolic, lovely, idyllic southern New Forest home, not far from where I live at the moment, in fact. And I think about that novel every time as I'm on the train home. Margaret loves the South. She has a perfect, idyllic childhood. Her father is a curate. But then he decides to leave the church because he just falls out with its changes in doctrine. And he doesn't lose his faith, but he does lose his faith in organised religion of that type. He can no longer be a man of the church. So he decides to be a tutor to the thrusting new middle classes of the North, who are sort of nouveau riche, really, and he moves north with his family. Margaret is devastated. She just really doesn't want to go. And here, as she travels north, is her first impression of Milton Northern, supposed to be Manchester. For several miles before they reached Milton, they saw a deep lead-coloured cloud hanging over the horizon in the direction in which it lay. It was all the darker from contrasts with the pale grey blue of the wintry sky. Nearer to the town, the air had a faint taste and smell of smoke. Quick, they were whirled over long, straight, hopeless streets of regularly built houses, all small and of brick. Here and there, a great oblong, many-windowed factory stood up, like a hen among her chickens, puffing out black, unparliamentary smoke. Unparliamentary smoke, by the way, means smoke that does not abide by the government's new regulations for factory owners to minimise their emissions, basically. You were supposed to have a furnace that burnt off some of the worst emissions of your factory, and these are clearly ones that didn't. There's a bit of law-breaking going on in the North, unusually. Poor Margaret misses her country cottage. I think we're really supposed to feel for her at this point. The move actually kills her mother, who never actually can stand the cold, gritty, dirty air of the North. And the family, when they try to settle into Milton, can never even find a new servant because Milton girls are all impertinent and don't see why they should be scullery maids when they could earn more in the factories. Here, there's a direct correlation being made between industrialisation and the breakdown of traditional class boundaries. But as the reference here to the factory as a mother hen and the workers' houses as her chicks implies, Margaret's encounter with the working class Higgins family changes everything. In her role as philanthropist, Margaret as mother hen, we might say, she becomes friends with Bessie Higgins, also 19 years old like Margaret, but not plump and healthy and, you know, fresh from the south, but dying of fluff in the lungs from working all her life since she was a child in unventilated mills. Margaret makes friends with her, is there when she dies, sees her through the worst parts of her illness. And Margaret even manages a rough kind of truce with Bessie's father, despite his drinking and his union activities. Most importantly, this novel shows us both the desperation, hunger, and personal loss, watching members of your family die, that drives people to go on strike. But it shows us equally the instability of global capitalism. Even Thornton's hard-earned fortune eventually melts away by the end of the book. He's a man of power at the beginning. He's powerless by the end, till Margaret rescues him. The crucial thing is there's suffering on both sides in this novel. And I think, crucially, Gaskell permits her working-class characters to take the middle-class reader by the hand and lead them into the sort of smoky darkness of the industrial city, and giving it humanity, and even, I think, in the end, a kind of nobility, but then I'm biased. Finally, she manages to change her southern heroines and, I think, her middle-class readers' mind about the North. They might learn to appreciate it as Margaret learns to love it. This does not happen just because she falls in love, Margaret, with an individual northerner, or even because she's learned to love and appreciate the variety and richness of northern life. It happens because she has grown up and broadened her horizons, and so has John Thornton. We get proof of Margaret's outlook when she returns to her beloved New Forest after the death of her parents and before she finds out how John feels about her. At first, Margaret is upset to find a new family in the vicarage where she grew up and which she has romanticised, really, and missed for so long. There's lots of reflections to roses round the door and honeysuckle, and some of them are quite ironic and quite wry, but I think there is definitely that sense of the sun's always shining in the New Forest, and it really doesn't in Milton Northern. Okay, here is what she finally realises after making that visit back south. A few days afterwards, after being upset, that is, for visiting her childhood home and finding a new family there, she had found her level and decided that she was very glad to have been there and that she had seen it again and that to her it would always be the prettiest spot in the world, but that it was so full of associations with former days and especially with her father and mother that she should shrink back from another visit. It's a really mature moment, I think, where she's learned home is where the heart is. To our eyes, this is probably a very sort of romanticised and idealised ending anyway. You know, Margaret comes into some money unexpectedly and is able to rescue John Thornton. So she's got the power. It's a bit like the ending of Jane Eyre where, you know, she'll only get with her hero where she actually is in a position of power because she's got the money. Same sort of outcome here. Quite satisfactory, but not exactly realistic, perhaps. So to our eyes, not a realistic portrayal of North-South relations. But interestingly, contemporary reviewers in the 1850s didn't think it was romanticised at all. In fact, they repeatedly attribute the acutest and most truthful realism to Gaskell's novel. Southern papers didn't say much about the story beyond, as usual, mentioning that it had begun in Dickens's journal. But the Northern papers had more to say. When I began looking for reviews of all these novels, I was struck, as I have recently been, particularly when researching reviews of Dickens, by the marked difference in its regional reception. We tend to think one was popular, one wasn't. It's much more complicated than that. And I think this reception of particular novels about North and South relations may be able to tell us more than the stories themselves about how Victorians were feeling about these relationships at this time. The Caledonian Mercury wrote, "Mrs. Gaskell's novel is a timeous and graphic daguerreotype of workmen's strikes." A daguerreotype, of course, being an early form of photograph. This is an explicit reference to its realism. It's almost photographic realism here. The Carlisle Journal agreed, in almost the same terms, that clever daguerreotypist of provincial life. The Fife Herald was still more fulsome in its praise, recognising that Gaskell had tried and largely succeeded to produce a balanced portrait. Apart from all the other merits of this periodical, i.e. Household Words, Mrs. Gaskell's story of North and South is itself worth greatly more than the price of a whole volume, to use an excessively hackneyed mode of speaking on the subject. Breadth, pathos, and naturalness, a deep sympathy with the poor, yet no meaningless condemnation of the rich, are the pervasive characteristics of a tale which marks out the author of Mary Barton as one of the leading writers of our day. Dickens often got a much more hostile press, perhaps because he was more famous. Hard Times, for example, was largely completely critically panned by the Southern and particularly the London papers. Bell's Sporting Life was gentle enough. It called Hard Times an admirable tale of life in the factory districts. It is a somewhat melancholy, but we fear too true, sketch of the manner in which the educational and managerial systems are carried on in the Midland counties. But even this review safely distances the problem as happening vaguely somewhere in the Midlands, when in fact it takes place in Lancashire. And few other London or Southern regional papers agreed with Bell's Sporting Life that the story had any merit at all. For Reynolds' newspaper, Hard Times is Dickens' most undramatic, confused, and incongruous tale. The Wells Journal says that he's exaggerating. Like Don Quixote, he makes the giant he destroys. The Morning Post is more critical still. Mr. Dickens ought to have reflected more carefully on the new system of producing ornamental design before he indulged in a reckless style of writing, which from its very boldness is calculated to make ill-conceived frivolity pass for firm conviction. The Morning Chronicle also took issue with Dickens' approach. It regretted that a writer who had done so much to improve the condition of the poor and to disseminate a feeling of universal benevolence should have taken so distorted a view of economic science and propagated such erroneous opinions of the object it was intended to serve. These Southern, and particularly metropolitan, reviewers apparently took offence at Dickens's attempt to engage with political philosophy, calling the novel sort of overblown and unreal, and accusing Dickens of meddling in things that he didn't understand. I think the discomfort over what Dickens is trying to stir up is really palpable here. Not so the Northern papers, most of which, interestingly, like Hard Times a lot better. Many regional papers even reprinted little chunks of the story, situating snippets of Dickens' descriptions of Northern factory town life in among their own factual reports, adverts, local news and jokes, as though they are reporting on truth and Dickens is part of that mosaic. Some, like the Belfast Mercury, reprinted the whole story as it appeared week by week, simply pirated it, and then got in trouble from Dickens because he was a real eagle-eyed copyright watcher and finally threatened them with legal action, so they had to stop. But they did so with very bad grace and in quite an interesting way. "We shall not, therefore, publish any more of it, and I'm not sorry, though, have just got rid of what was growing tedious." But many other papers continue to reprint short extracts, not whole chapters, not exactly piracy, but just sort of lifting interesting little bits. Dickens is very good at that sort of capsular narrative, which means you can easily lift a little bit out of context and it will still make sense. He never interfered with papers who did this. It didn't bother him. In fact, as with all other novels since Pickwick in 1836-7, Dickens understood that a few short extracts lifted here and there and dropped into local papers without permission simply spread his fame and helped the sales of his novels. So he permitted that. The Leeds Mercury, to give you a few examples of how this is working, on August the 26th, 1854, reprinted Mr. Bitzer's Philosophy, which takes utilitarianism to its logical conclusion and returns and refuses to sort of save Tom Gradgrind, who's a thief, basically, and a horrible human being, from the law, because sentiment is out of place. Mr. Gradgrind's taught Mr. Bitzer that sentiment is out of place. Of course I'm not going to save your son. I don't feel anything for him because feelings are wrong. So, you know, the irony here is clearly being revelled in by this paper. The Fireside Readings section of the Huddersfield Chronicle and West Yorkshire The Fireside Reading section of the Huddersfield Chronicle and West Yorkshire Advertiser reprinted the section called Coketown on a Summer's Day. This little bit they printed. The streets were hot and dusty on the summer day, and the sun was so bright that it even shone through the heavy vapour drooping over Coketown and could not be looked at steadily. Stokers emerged from low underground doorways into factory yards and sat on steps and posts and palings, wiping their swarthy visages and contemplating coals. The whole town seemed to be frying in oil. There was a stifling smell of hot oil everywhere. The steam engines shone with it. The dresses of the hands were soiled with it. The mills throughout their many stories oozed and trickled with it. This could have been the newspaper's way of drawing attention to the dirty conditions of northern cities. But it is situated among some sprightly regional news which celebrates local identity. And in fact, in that positioning on the page of the newspaper, Dickens's description of workers sweltering under the hot sun and oil in a blanket of smoke seems to be taken as a compliment, even forming part of how West Yorkshire readers thought of themselves. It came as something of a surprise to me to find that the adoption of Dickens as a champion of regionalism was so overwhelming. He's so often thought of as a London writer, and critics have always said that Hard Times was not popular. It was universally disliked amongst the big sort of London papers, and it certainly didn't sell very well. But clearly there's a different story amongst regional reviewers, and particularly in the North. While some regional papers didn't like it, the Dundee Courier is one of them, thought it was dull, overdrawn and even unnatural, the Inverness Courier feels there's a great deal of truth in the story. The Fife Herald thinks it's powerfully told and full of large-hearted kindliness. The Western Times, Saturday 1854, 27th of May 1854, calls the first 11 chapters interesting and useful. We are glad to see that Mr. Dickens has devoted himself to the treatment of this social evil. They over-chapel and under-school the people. The consequence is the chapels are half empty and the public houses are all full. Improvement must follow on his teaching. The Aberdeen Weekly Compendium, I love this one. The Aberdeen Weekly Compendium, the Huddersfield Chronicle and West Yorkshire Advertiser and the Bradford Observer all spotted the likeness between the story's immoral social climber, James Harthouse, and a certain right honourable gentleman well known in the ranks of the advanced Liberal Party. The right honourable gentleman was finally named with some glee as Mr. Milner Gibson in the Huddersfield Chronicle and West Yorkshire Advertiser on August the 12th, 1854. They were so proud to be able to name him. And the radical modernising paper, the Falkirk Herald, reprinted one of Stephen Blackpool's sections under the title A Working Man's Notion of a Working Man's Grievances, in which Stephen explains how poverty, uncertain employment and the inability to resolve his unhappy marriage, because he can't afford a divorce basically, have all ruined his life. Many critics have tended to see Stephen as a sort of unbelievable and rather tedious exaggeration of the downtrodden. But this indicates, I think, at least, that for the Falkirk Herald, Stephen is saying something that needs to be said, a working man's notion of a working man's grievances. In fact, Dickens' political intent in this book was widely recognised and championed by those whom it most nearly affected, those in both the industrial and the struggling rural towns outside London. And this, I think, has been my most interesting find of all recently. Tense North and South relations are high on the agenda, as I have shown. But when the chips are down, and when a writer begins to point the finger of blame towards Parliament, Northern and Southern regional newsmen unite in one common feeling, a profound distrust of Westminster, the heart of politics, which was then as now seen as turning a blind eye to the problems faced by residents, not just in the north, but in every other part of Britain that wasn't the metropolis. This becomes evident more clearly still in the reviews of Great Expectations in 1860, which, although set exclusively in the south, was championed all over the country by regional newspapers pouncing with delight on its bitter critique of debauched London life. Even in the 1880s, when this edition was published, public attention centred on the pivotal moment where Pip leaves the country and goes to London and starts on the slippery slope to moral ruin. This image sums up the problem for me, a nation at a crossroads, looking forward with trepidation and backwards with nostalgia. And the heart of the problem is situated in London's parliamentary politics. I think I'll stop there. Thank you.